Hi, you're listening to Love Work, Skills for a Relational Life, and I'm Jerry Sander in New York. Here's my co-host, Christy Gaisford in Salt Lake City. Hi, Christy.
Hi, Jerry. How's it going?
It's going well. We got a really good topic from someone who is a listener who wanted us to talk about something that I think is really good topic. Mm-hmm. So here's what she wrote. She wanted us to discuss how religious upbringing affects the two people in a relationship, even if they don't consider themselves observant or practicing. She said, I think it might not occur to people who are not currently religiously observant or who might not even believe in God that the faith of their childhood formed some of their values and beliefs, and this therefore impacts relationship dynamics. This could happen even in different denominations of the same religion. She went on, for many religions, there's a big difference in how suffering is viewed. At least I perceive there is this difference between me, raised Jewish, and my husband, raised Catholic. Most religious texts implicitly or explicitly convey beliefs about the roles and status of men versus women. Does the religion encourage or discourage questioning and discussion about tenets of faith, etc.?
Lots of good questions.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Lots to dig in about. So I offer it to you to start. Anywhere you want to start with all that.
Oh, thank you. I think this could probably be many podcasts to cover all of that. But just to start today, I did think about what she said. And I think that a lot of what happens is when we don't examine the influence of our childhood or our religious upbringing or cultural upbringing, and we consciously live these things out because they're familiar to us and they feel normal. And a lot of times when we assume that something is normal or familiar, we don't really question it. And it's not till we're in a close relationship and we come up against somebody who doesn't have the same beliefs or background or understanding that we start to question these things. And they start to become issues. So I think that it's not even just the religion, but how that religion was lived in your family or your mm-hmm. close community. Mm-hmm. And when she said the role of suffering, mm-hmm. one thing I thought, I was trying to think about a lot of the couples I'd worked with and how these issues have come up. And one of the things about suffering is that one person believes strongly that in duty and work before play. Mm-hmm. And suffering is noble, mm-hmm. and we're rewarded for our suffering. So we must do all of these things before we're allowed to have fun or to enjoy mm-hmm. things.
That's that's a beautiful example. And that can even translate down to something as mundane as let's get all this work done before we relax or before we can relax versus someone else saying, why can't you just relax?
Mm-hmm.
So there may be a real basis in early childhood feeling from your family. I'm thinking, you know, it's sort of an atmosphere you pick up on as a child about certain beliefs, even more than understanding faith tenets or what does my religion believe. It's more textures. So to me, I thought, you know, do people recall, let's say, the way their parents embraced religion or didn't as warm and cozy and welcoming? Or was it a scary, punitive, fearful, obligatory feeling in the home? Were you encouraged to ask a lot of questions and be curious about things? Or was that off limits and you're just supposed to conform and do things first and obey, leave the questions for later. I remember speaking to an Orthodox Jewish guy once about this, and he was saying, he was ultra Orthodox, and he said the commandment is to do, then ask questions, you know, mm-hmm. but you have to do it. So the focus is on do it. Do it this way. Questions can wait. Whereas other traditions are like, I have a lot of questions about this. I want to wrestle with this mm-hmm. because I've seen my parents wrestle with it or something.
And just because it is, I mean, I want to know why. I don't want to do it unless I understand why.
Right. And other, I mean, fundamentalists, there's fundamentalists in every religion. So I'm not picking on one religion. Every religion has its fundamentalists and then people who question things. So the fundamentalists would say what you just said, just do it. Just be quiet and do what we say. It's not even important for you to understand why.
Yeah.
Because this is the way it's done. Now that suggests a type of hierarchy that can easily get translated to your relationship, you know, where it's rigid and in a very demarcated role. You do this, I do that, don't ask why. At its extreme.
Right.
And for I think for a couple to be a happy fundamentalist couple, they have to both buy into that.
Yeah.
You're not going to sit around wondering why.
Yeah, I've had couples where it's pretty patriarchal, and it is kind of like, we're doing this because I say so. Mm-hmm. And then the wife came from a background of service. So our job is to serve others. And we get our value by being of service to other people. And mm-hmm. so she said her whole family ended up in codependent marriages because mm-hmm. they kind of learned early on that our needs don't matter, that we're supposed to be here to help other people. And so they learned to put up with way too much when it came to themselves. And if you pair that person with the more domineering person, it's a perfect codependent relationship.
Did they develop a bunch of resentment?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It took a while. Yeah. She said it took all of them almost 20 years of marriage to wake up and say, why are we all unhappy and why are we all doormats in our marriages?
You know, it's funny. We don't seem to have time in a week to even talk about who's going shopping, you know, but let alone what are your beliefs about religion and suffering and stuff. But it's really important, I think, to do so every year because things change too. Like one's own philosophical beliefs don't stay static your whole life unless you are a very convinced fundamentalist and it never wavers. So you can think about your place in the universe and ideas of God one way when you're 13, another way completely when you're 18, and a really different way when you're 35. So even after you've met someone, let's say, and gotten married, that doesn't mean you're not going to continue to evolve. And it seems important. You know, I was talking to my wife about this yesterday. I was thinking of someone who's always complaining, but who's a Buddhist, you know? Mm-hmm. And I thought, wait, isn't the first noble truth in Buddhism life is suffering? And we looked it up, and we looked at what, I think there were four noble truths. I should know this, either four or five noble truths in Buddhism. And there was a rationale and a philosophy behind saying that life is suffering. Basically, it was saying, if you look around, you see a lot of suffering. How can we have less suffering, you know? But I loved having that conversation with my wife about life and how much suffering's inevitable and how do you view the way it's all set up. It was just not only fun, it seemed important to sort of explore, you know, what at this point in our life do we really believe?
Mm-hmm. Because it does evolve. It's true.
Doesn't it?
It does. I think they're very important conversations as well. Another one I thought that comes up a lot based on our childhood is guilt and sort of this concept of right and wrong. And people can be really hard on themselves. I'll be super hard on myself because I'm not allowed to make mistakes. This is sort of like something that was ingrained in them. And then they become resentful of other people who do get to make mistakes. And this is that's subconscious. But I've kind of discovered this many times in therapy. Like, why are you resentful? Where is this coming from? And in really digging, it does come back from, well, I always have to do the right thing, so how come they get to mess up? And it's something out of their view almost, or I always have to be serious and do the right thing, and I always have to be the responsible one, so how come they get to go have fun? When really, I mean, no one's stopping them except for these sort of rigid beliefs from really early on. And that's why it's so important to uncover them and question and really dig into them.
I mean, at what age did that person start feeling that versus isn't it an adult thing to recognize that everybody makes mistakes?
Right.
And everybody makes mistakes. And you're probably much more forgiving of that person over there who's making a mistake than you might be of yourself if you have a tendency to be perfectionistic or believe you're not supposed to make any mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think we have to really look at ourselves with honesty and ask, where did that come from? And do I still believe it right now and want to believe it this next coming year?
Right. And sometimes, like, if we are feeling resentful, we need to ask ourselves, what are we missing and what are we not giving mm-hmm. ourselves?
Yeah, even, you know, this is perfect timing because we're recording this right after Yom Kippur is over.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did a day of reflection, and it's really kind of Jewish equivalent of confession, only it's the entire community confessing all the ways that it fell short and didn't do the things we said we'd do last year, and wanting to consider, well, what do you want to have be different for the next year? And I think almost every religion has some mechanism that allows for recognizing mistakes and flaws and faults and trying to do better. Mm-hmm. They call it different things. But why are we so slow on the uptake to not go in that direction and go so often in the condemning ourselves very harshly direction?
Right. Just accepting that we do make mistakes and everybody else does, so why do we defend ourselves so much?
And this is what we teach in the boot camp, isn't it? You know, that mistakes are made on a regular basis between couples.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a way, if people have come from a religious background, from a real significantly religious background, they're probably trying to set up a household between them and their spouse the way they believe you're supposed to, which is to mirror somehow godliness or holiness or relationship to God reflected in the household. But if you don't believe you're allowed to make any mistakes with God, you know, are you allowed to make mistakes with your spouse? Because mistakes are being made all over the place.
Right.
And how do you process that then? If you're
and
that
with
rigid.
Each other, right?
So what's the? I mean, this is what we try and teach people in the boot camps: is repair. What's the mechanism of repair? And how does that fit in with your worldview? And again, does it change over time?
It has to, right? As our experiences change. I wrote some more things that I think come up a lot.
Yeah.
One is a huge one that we could spend many podcasts on is just that we were, most of us, raised in a patriarchal society. And because of patriarchy, there's so many unspoken understandings that even if we don't logically agree with, we all were kind of boiled in that water growing up, and it's such a part of things. So one is that it comes up a lot is that there's an unspoken understanding that children are the woman's job. Yeah. And if it's a woman is going to be the automatic default of childcare or making sure the kids' needs are met. And even when people say that's not the case, it's usually there on some level. And so if arrangements need to be made, it's usually the default that mom will make them or will be home. And if it's different, if mom's the primary primary breadwinner, and mm-hmm. and the whole system is the opposite, it's still patriarchy still gets in there a lot because moms feel guilty that they're not home with their kids more. And dads feel like, well, maybe I don't want to be home with the kids. Why did I get this role? And there's so much more questioning because it goes against the norm.
Anytime you're doing something, it doesn't look like the usual picture. And the usual picture is very intertwined with religion, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You know, that patriarchal underpinning is what people try to set up in their household very often without even knowing it, I think. They just would label it being a good mom or being a good dad or being a good husband or being a good wife.
Yeah, and even...
I mean, we need to have more conversations about that. What is a good wife, you know?
Right. I think that even though so many of these situations are changing, I mean, I'm sure so many, but the weight of expectation is still there. Like, men still feel less than if their wife out-earns them. And women yeah. still feel guilty if they spend too much time away from the children. And that's because of the way it's set up. Mm-hmm. And so... I think a lot of that guilt can override and kind of undermine relationships too, if it's not just spoken about.
Now, you know, I'm thinking as you're speaking that another whole way religion can come into this is when people reject forcefully the religion that they were exposed to very early on mm-hmm. and just say, no, I'm not going to believe in that. And I don't want that in my life or in my household in that way either. That's easier to say than what do we believe?
Right.
You know?
What do we replace that with?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So there's sometimes where people get caught, they'll get a real strict version of their parents' religion and end up with a fierce reaction to that version of God, thinking that everyone in that religion believes that version of God, when it's not even true right. that not everyone in that religion believes that version of God. I find a great variety within each of these religions about how people view God.
Yeah, it's very true.
And to me, the the percentage that are open-minded individuals who like to ask questions and I would say wrestle with the idea of God, they have more in common across the different religions, those open-minded people, than you do with the fundamentalists in your own religion.
Mm-hmm.
They have more in common.
Right.
And interestingly, one of the things the fundamentalists, I mean, I'll say this, so if anyone takes exception to this, direct your comments to me. One of the things the fundamentalists most have in common, whichever religion they're in, is controlling the role of women and controlling women in general, of how women can dress, what women can do, and when they can do it. So that seems to be the first target of fundamentalist religions across the board. And yeah, that's in the relationship.
Right. Which all goes
under. I mean, I wonder, do you ever have clients who find out afterwards what their spouse really believes, but hadn't really talked about it a lot ahead of time?
Nothing's coming to mind right now.
Yeah.
What about you?
I find people who are like one spouse is more sick of the religion they were raised in than the other one, who may have some fond feelings for it, but not believe everything they were raised in, you know? And then the arguments are about, what do we celebrate? How do we celebrate it? What, you know, how much do we want to go to the place of worship? What do we want to do with our kids?
Yeah, all of this come up a lot.
And the, again, we mentioned this in an earlier podcast, that the largest growing, fastest growing segment of people in this country was non-believers in anything in particular, or just identified as spiritual. And that attendance at lots and lots of places of worship has been declining, particularly since COVID. So now that it's more of an effort to go out, like you don't have to go out to see a movie. You can see a movie from your living room. And COVID made it so you could kind of zoom in on your house of worship if you wanted to.
Right.
And now, right?
Yeah, I just read it in something in the New York Times that was talking about just the loss of community through all of that. Because one of the things that people have gotten from religion for centuries is that sense of community, that somebody cares about you and somebody will show up for you. And that is something that's lost.
Yeah, and this epidemic of loneliness that the Surgeon General is talking about. Like, if what people used to go to priests and rabbis for, by way of asking for help with difficult issues, if that's really been replaced on some level by therapy and therapists, then how do people get together in a community and acknowledge their commonality? You know, like, how does that happen if that has broken down? I don't have an answer for that.
No, I think people try to find other ways, but I don't think it's quite the same. It's especially if it is one-on-one.
So there are religions that give people, I mean, there are interpretations of religion that give people a sense of meaning and a feeling of belonging and goodness in the universe. And then there's ones that give people a sense of obligation and keep your mouth shut and just do what we say.
Well, I think the exact same religion can have a different effect on two different people. It's the way that...
Say more about that. Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily the religion as it is about how that person was given or taught or received that religion and how they interpret it. So what can be great for one person can be kind of stifling and hurtful for somebody else. And so that's why it comes up in a marriage as well, is can we respect each other's experience and make room for both of us to believe and to worship or not worship the way that we feel, you know, without trying to control our partner.
Yeah, you're talking about having both a boundary and self-esteem to say, here's kind of how this all occurs to me. I know I'm not you. What's it like for you? It's easier said than done. Go ahead.
Well, I just think a few other things that I think come up if that's not explored is guilt. I think that can be a big part of people's life. So I'm not doing enough. I'm not measuring up. I'm always really hard on myself. And then we can kind of project that onto our partner. You're not doing enough. We're not doing enough.
Yeah, I think that's what the person who was asking the question was getting to, was this what we do project onto our partner.
Yeah, and we take our guilt out on them, which I even just had today in my office. It's, I know you think I'm the worst. I'll never be enough for you. And it really was more of a projection of, I don't feel good about myself. I'm always hard on myself. I've never measured up. And now I assume that you feel the same way about me. And the partner was like, that's not how I feel. Why do you keep saying that? But that's a way that I think some of those roots come up. Were we raised in shame and guilt? Mm-hmm. And
it's a very individualized experience, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah.
It's almost like if you ask people who've had their tonsils out as a kid, how was it? You know, someone say it was fun. I got like a lollipop and I got a free ice cream or something. And someone else, well, I remember, this is a true story. I remember the nurse like saying she wanted to read a book to me. And then I sat on her lap and she flipped me over and gave me a shot in my butt.
Oh.
It's like, yeah, so that wasn't fun.
No.
And so you talk to two people who had like the same medical experience and you get two totally different stories. Talk to two people who've had the same, like CCD is a Catholic thing, Catholic school in that parallels elementary school. The kids, Catholic kids have to go to if their parents want them to. It's like religious education. Talk to kids who went to CCD. They may have very different experiences depending upon the nun, whether they had a nun or a lay teacher or someone they really liked who was kind or someone who was mean and cruel. You know?
Oh yeah. I wrote that down. If you had like an amazing, kind nun, you have these beautiful feelings about the church and the school. If you had a really harsh one, you might not want anything to do with it. And it's based on this experience that you had.
And I think we would be not doing our job if we didn't also add the possibility of abuse,
mm-hmm.
that there's abuse that happens within religious places, which is an outrage of its own category because you're messing with little kids' heads about what God wants you to do. You're seen as some sort of spokesperson for God, and the damage that's done when there's abuse, either physical, emotional, or sexual, within that context.
Yeah, that could really
almost everlasting.
As an adult, your mistrust of systems, your mistrust of any kind of authority.
It's interesting, though. I'd love to run a whole group sometime and get people to open up about this because it seems to me it doesn't take many stupid things said by a clergy person or a religious teacher to turn someone off forever, or a certain experience in a religion. Like my mother, when she wanted to go to an Orthodox synagogue that my grandfather went to, and then learned that the girls and women had to sit upstairs in a separate area partitioned off from the men who were the main act, you know? And once she saw that, that was it. She was like turned off for it forever. And sometimes it just takes one thing like that. And people are like, you know, that's it. Include me out. And then if you meet a spouse who's potentially had a benign, positive experience with it, better talk about it.
Right. And this usually is so much more complicated than that. Because we're all mm-hmm. a part of the system. It's not just the men hurting the women. It's this whole system that's been created where both people are hurt in different ways. Go ahead.
You know, our person who asked the question said, does the religion encourage or discourage questioning? I mean, even questioning the tenets of the faith. You know, why is life suffering or something like that? Or if someone shrugs and says, you know, if someone comes home and says, I'm miserable at work, someone goes, well, life is suffering, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Does your religion encourage wrestling around with it? Some do to an extent that's almost painful. I mean, in Judaism, I think it's Jacob wrestled with the angels, came down. And after waking up in the morning, there's a section of the Bible that says, because you've wrestled with angels, I'll name you Israel. And since then, Israel has been translated as God wrestlers, mm-hmm. like wrestling with God. So any sort of paragraph of something that's written as liturgy is commented on by another person that's like this five paragraphs and someone else commenting in his commentary for 10 paragraphs. A lot of robust argument What did that paragraph mean? Whereas in some other traditions, I don't know that if that's as welcome. It's very much expected in Judaism, you know, in most Judaism, but not fundamentalist, Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Judaism.
Well, I was just thinking how that translates to relationships. I think what happens is in a lot of relationships, how it translates on a smaller level is there's a right way and there's a wrong way. And there's a good thing and a bad thing. And we judge our partners based on what we've been raised to think is good or bad. And some of them that I wrote down that seem so simple but cause a lot of issues is reading is good, video games are bad. They're a waste of time. Being outside in nature is good. Watching a movie inside or on screens are bad. Chores before play is good. Play before chores is not good. Play just for the sake of play, not good. So things like this, that messages that we get growing up can come play out every day. You're going to play video games again, you know, and you just see the anger and the angst that comes up. But it really comes back to this whole thing that we took in as we grew up of like, no, that's not okay. We're supposed to work on Saturday. And someone else is like, what are you talking about? Saturday's for family day. Saturday's to have fun. And you get those two and it becomes a fight every single Saturday.
Well, yes. And that's the beauty of two people who both believe in the same religion that said X day is the day of rest. And here's what's supposed to happen on that Sabbath day. And they're told what's going to happen on that Sabbath day. You're going to make breakfast, going to go to services, you're going to come home, you're going to not turn on the TV, you're not going to play video games. And at some point in the day, you're going to, well, I'll just throw this out there. At some point in the day, you're going to connect physically, sexually with your partner as part of the actual expectation in certain Orthodox Jewish communities. That's an expectation. It's how to do it. You start out the day like this. It includes physical closeness. If someone's traveling and is far away, they have to come home by Shabbat starting so that can happen. And it's kind of rock solid, like everyone knows what to expect. So if you know that and you're both into that, there's no real problems on the surface. If you don't, and you're just trying to, like many people do, wing it and figure out what a Saturday and Sunday is going to be like and who has what games you have to go to or what obligations and who's shopping, then it's more challenging.
Yeah, and if you just expect that you're going to be similar.
How many times do we work with couples trying to figure out when to connect physically, sexually, finding time in the week, reading each other's signs and signals, not wanting to be rigid about it, but they end up just being far away from each other. Like they're trying to read each other's minds and I don't know. So there's no dialogue, even like what you want your Saturday to be like, what I want my Saturday to be like, if you're outside of that sort of fundamentalist orbit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I it's true. And it's not to say that any of them are bad either. There's a lot of great things about everything we're talking about, like about taking care of other people, about worshiping, about being mindful and grateful and all these things. But if there's no discussion about it and you don't feel like there's room, that's where it really
The discussion has to be like charitable too. The discussion can't be like you're doing this wrong, you know. If someone likes to play video games, I would really want to know what they like most about it. I just don't want to condemn it because it's not for me. But I don't want them to isolate themselves in video game land at the expense of connecting with me.
Which happens a lot. From what I hear, they're long games.
Yeah.
I hear women complain about this.
Oh my gosh. I call it like the man boys, you know, who like been doing this since they were 12 and they're doing it now that they're 35 and they're waiting for the next release of the next big game and
or 50.
And they don't really see what the problem is, you know, and they've learned to check out of the present moment and the person in the room with you. They've learned that, I mean, at its most benign, it's self-soothing, right? It's like some hobby. It's like knitting. Are you going to yell at someone for knitting? But if it becomes their way of checking out and saying, don't bother me, don't contact me because I'm looking at a screen, it almost doesn't matter what's on the screen.
Well, I think the problem is you can put knitting down, but you're always right in the middle of the game and you're just about to get to the next whatever. So they have a hard time getting away from it.
Dopamine hit. Yeah. Yeah, we definitely do a podcast about ways people intoxicate themselves into loneliness and disconnecting from the person sitting right next to them. But I think if we leave the religious model, if you have chosen to leave a religious model that was prescribed for you, then you do have to look at what your values are, what's important to you, when you get to spend time together, when you spend time outside, and when you have sex and make love, and when you go shopping. You have to put it together. You have to talk to each other in order to put it together.
Yeah, and how is your childhood wiring affecting you in ways that you haven't really explored? What are you just acting out unconsciously?
And if you had a bad experience in the religion you were raised in, does that automatically mean you want no religion for your child? What if your spouse wants one? Either is the one you came from or it's not. I think if it's not talked about with some degree of kindness, it can build resentment.
Or if you had a great experience and you love it and you want to stay in it, can you can you allow your spouse to have a different experience?
That seems to be the key issue with religions, doesn't it? Can you have the other person have a good experience with different beliefs?
Yeah.
I'd say that's the advanced class if you can, because that shows boundaries. Like, yeah, that's good. That's your holiday. That's your thing. I'm so glad for you. I'll even join in celebrating your holiday and honoring your holiday, but it's not mine. It's not mine.
Yeah, I have an example of somebody that grew up in a religious household and then he left the religion. But what he took with him was this idea that family was everything and that he had to sacrifice all his own needs for his family and he shouldn't have outside interests or hobbies.
Of any sort.
Not really. And if he did, he felt guilty because he should be giving everything to family. And then he married somebody who loved her outside interests, friends, hobbies. And years in the marriage ended up really having all this resentment that why did she get to do all these things and he didn't? And it really did take therapy to help him realize, who says you can't do that? Mm-hmm. Well, that's just what I saw growing up. I thought a good husband put everything into his family. And so these are the things we're talking about, this kind of unconscious beliefs that we carry on without really stopping to question, why do I even think that? Where am I getting that from? And why am I resenting my wife right now for taking care of herself? Well, maybe I got the wrong message or I misinterpreted this message.
I never heard till social work graduate school the phrase, differences are not deficits. And it's so helpful.
Yeah, it's a good one.
You don't have to like the same things as your partner. You really don't. And that doesn't mean you have to convert your partner to liking opera or liking a certain religion or something. You just need to be able to talk about all this freely without coercion. And unfortunately, people do apply coercion to this stuff and get really hot really fast. You know, we're coming up on another political cycle too. And I'm dreading that. You remember how much pain people were in about disagreeing with their spouse politically around certain charismatic political figures. We're coming up on that again. with the same figures.
Yeah.
So I dread that because it seemed like open-minded people who attributed goodness to their partner were in small supply.
Yeah. All right. Should we have our fight?
Okay. All right. What are we going to fight about? What to fight about?
You're going to get mad at me because I don't appreciate any of your hard work or the life you provide for me.
Okay. You know, Christy, it would be nice for, let me figure this out. By the way, Christy and I are not married. We're married to other people, but we know how to fight and make it sound good. So, Christy, it'd be nice every now and then if you would acknowledge that my hard work and contributions really make our good life possible, instead of just reminding me of what else I have to do and when I have to do it.
It's kind of hard for me to appreciate you when you're so hard on me all the time. You're always in a bad mood, and I'm really sick of all the little comments you
make. Bad mood?
Yeah.
Little comments?
Yeah, I'm really sick of them. Like, oh, you call that dinner? Why didn't you make a vegetable?
Or, I was kidding around.
Well, it's not funny. Or, if you where's have the clean a sense clothes? Of humor, you didn't get to the laundry again? Like, those, like,
when did I
they just really start to add up, and it's really hard for me to feel appreciative.
So marriage is supposed to just be somber, serious all the time.
No, I'm talking about your rude comments that put me down for things I do or don't do.
I just gave a, yeah, or don't do. Thank you. All right. So this is like, you're not going to acknowledge the hard work I do unless I let up on trying to be funny.
It's not being funny. I'm not talking about being funny. I'm talking about when you're critical of me and you don't seem to appreciate any of the hard work I do. So you want me to sit and thank you all the time, but what are you? You're not thanking me. I'm working my butt off too in different ways.
All right.
You're speechless.
What are we having for dinner?
Lasagna.
We have that last Sunday or something?
This is what I'm talking about. You're so rude. I just made an entire dinner, and that's your comment. Didn't we have that last week?
I'm just asking. I can't do this. I've been working to not be this way, so that was hard.
Okay, so do it again, and I'll respond differently.
Okay, and I'll do it differently. All right, so, you know, it's frustrating, Christy, to, like, work so hard and come home, and all I get met with sometimes a list of what things I haven't done, when I have to do things, and where, and what the to-do list is for the weekend.
So it sounds like you're feeling unappreciated.
Yeah. I mean, not always, but, you know, yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I'm certainly unappreciated at work, and then come home, I just like a little appreciation, you know?
What do you feel like I don't appreciate?
That I choose to do the full-time job with the hours and the people who I have to work with in exchange for a good income, you know?
Yeah, you know, I do really appreciate that. I'm sorry I don't say it enough because I know it's not easy. And I do appreciate the fact that you carry that weight and that I don't have to.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I don't want to, you know, overstate it. You have said things about it sometimes, so thank you. And I know you're doing a lot around here, and it's not getting seen. And I'm not always in a good enough, clear enough place where I see and thank you. So still recovering from my day, and I get very inner, you know.
Is there a way that I could, you know, bring something to your attention or ask you to do something that wouldn't feel like I'm, you know, loading more onto you?
Yeah, as long as I could say, give me 5 minutes or something, I'm still bouncing around inside myself. If I could say that, you know, like give me 5 minutes, I'm just like doing, I just got a lot going on. If I could say that, then I could hear really. I do want to know what needs to be done. I get disorganized. I look around like, whoa, too much stuff to do.
So maybe so I could even wait to ask you anything for 5 minutes. And you could still
take five minutes. Then I'd want to hear. And maybe we could write it down or have that weekly house meeting that Jerry and Christy told us about, you know, like 20 minutes long with we just do to-do lists and get that junk out of the way. And then, you know, then we'd be like on the same page, you know, wouldn't feel like a battle.
Okay. That sounds like a good idea. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's it. That's how to connect, folks. It's not rocket science. It's just, let's look at what you did that worked.
Well, but what do you think I did? Yeah, I'll tell you what I did.
What I think you did that worked is instead of saying, yeah, but, and putting your case out there of everything that I was doing wrong, you truly listened to how I felt and acknowledged that must be difficult because it was partly true.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's another part of it of me not acknowledging stuff for you, but you waited until I could get unbent and hear the apology or walking towards me that you did and acknowledging a truth. And then that opened us up to different level, I think. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think I tried to go straight to your feeling and take my story out of it. And if I focus on how you were feeling, I figured that you would be less and less upset as long as you were heard and validated.
You see, I think what you did was an advanced skill because you took your feelings and ego out of it for a minute. Like you put it on hold for a minute, which a lot of people can't do. I mean, that's what we're trying to teach people to do is...
It is hard.
For a minute, make it not all about you.
But it's so much easier in the long run, right?
Yeah, the rewards are so much better. Speaking of which, we're doing a boot camp in Santa Barbara, California at the end of October 28th, 29th, I think it is, right before Halloween. And you can come out and do this stuff with us. We've got a good group shaping up. The West Coast is always fun.
Yes.
Also, if you have a topic you'd like us to deal with or a question like our person did, you can get in touch with us by going to loveworkrelationships.com/connect/, just write to us what you think we should talk about or a very specific question you have, and we'll take it from there.
All right. I'll see you this weekend.
Right. See you next time. See you this weekend for a boot camp.
Yep. Take care.
Bye.